Ladies and gentlemen, let me all welcome you here in the Liberální Institute of Prague. I'm very glad you came, despite the fact that the seminar is unusual and traditionally in English rather than Czech. However, hopefully there will not be a big problem. As you know, we are here today to celebrate the publication of this great book by Professor Robert Hicks, Political Economy of Fear. So, first of all, let me welcome Dr. Hicks. We are very happy he joined us for not only for this discussion, but as many of you know, for the whole lecture series at the Prague School of Economics on political economy, or the political economy in the light of history. Professor Robert Hicks got his PhD from Johns Hopkins University, and he taught in several universities such as University of Washington, Lafayette College, or Seattle University. He is an author of numerous books. The most famous one being Crisis and Leviathan, to which he added, actually last year, if I'm not mistaken, a book called Against Leviathan, continuing his long-term analysis of the causes of the growth of the state. However, that's not his only research interest. He wrote articles on healthcare issues, on drugs, on regulations of drugs, but also on slavery or several other issues related to the analysis of property rights or institutions or development of institutions. He published in the most prestigious economic journals such as American Economic Review, Journal of Political Economy, or Journal of Economic History, but also to liberty-oriented journals such as Review of Austrian Economics or the Cato Journal. He is not only an author publishing scholarly articles, but he contributed tens or perhaps hundreds of articles to popular journals and newspapers. When I asked him to send me his CV a couple of months ago for the purposes of getting him as a visiting professor to the Prague School of Economics, he sent me the file that was 52 pages, full of actually list of publications he have published over the course of last 40 or something years, which is pretty impressive. Today, we have this privilege to celebrate the publication of his first book in Czech language. It's not a book that would have an English equivalent. It is a collection of his best papers and articles, ranging from broad analysis of the causes of the growth of the state, but also including some applications such as a chapter on the origin of the income tax, a chapter on conscription as a basis for the state expansion in the United States, and a couple of other interesting things. Well, without wasting more of your time, I just need to tell you that the book will be sold here. You'll be the first one who will have a chance to buy it with a special discount. The price of the book, like the regular price, will be 300 crowns. You can get it only today from us for 200 crowns. So act now. Or actually wait for Professor Hicks's lecture and then go and buy our books. Professor Hicks will be happy to hear why is it that governments try to scare us. So please, you have some 20-30 minutes to elaborate on the basic idea behind the book and actually your whole work, please.
Well, thank you, Professor Shima. Before I begin my talk, I want to express my gratitude to Professor Shima and all of his colleagues who have cooperated in producing this book. I have so far learned 6 words in the Czech language, so I would have had great difficulty writing the book myself, I've placed my entire trust in Professor Shima and his colleagues and their ability to translate my work into the Czech language, but I have complete confidence in him, so I'm sure that I do know what the book says, even if I can't read the Czech language. I'm also very grateful to the University of Economics and its Faculty of Economics and Public Administration for inviting me to present a course of lectures at the university, and I'm almost halfway through that now. If the students continue to come, I will continue to speak. Also to the Liberal Institute, which has sponsored not only my visit here to Prague this time, but 4 years ago as well, and has also helped to disseminate some of my writings earlier in its publications. So I'm very grateful for the interest these people have shown in my work. This is one of life's surprises for me. Not too many years ago, I would not have dreamed that I would be sitting in Prague talking about my research, but this is a good sign. Not all surprises are bad ones. Right after the attacks of September 11th in New York and on the Pentagon, I received a number of calls from journalists asking me to give my opinion about what I thought would be done in response to those attacks. And that may seem a little odd, and I suppose it seemed a little odd even to me, because I'm not at the top of the calling list for every journalist in America, and usually when they call, it has nothing to do with terrorism or foreign affairs. But I think there was a reason why they began to contact me and to ask for my views, because they had some familiarity with an earlier book of mine, which Professor Shima mentioned, called A Crisis and Leviathan, a book published in 1987 by the Oxford University Press. And that book was a beginning for me. I began my career almost 40 years ago, and in the early days I did not work on on government or government policies or the growth of government or any topics such as that, but I did develop an interest in those subjects because I had a colleague when I was teaching at the University of Washington in Seattle, whose name is Douglas North, and if you follow economics, you've probably heard of him, because he was awarded a Nobel Prize in 1993 jointly with Robert Fogel for his work in economic history. North had a long-standing interest in the relationships between government and the economy, and he was, I think, the best-known expert on that subject among the economic historians of the United States. And So I knew what he had written, and in fact, I spent many hours in his office arguing with him over many years about many issues connected with the area in which he had done research. And eventually, I decided that rather than simply quarrel with my colleague, I would write my own book and try to put down in print some of my reasons for differing with North in some respects, not in all. But that brought me into a new area of study as a scholar, as a historian, and as an economist. And it turned out to be the area to which I would devote most of my effort from that time onward. And I continue to work in that area now as time permits. I'm no longer a professor. I did leave university teaching 12 years ago, and I now edit a quarterly journal called The Independent Review for an organization called The Independent Institute. But my work still allows me to do some writing, and I'm continuing to do what I can to extend my understanding and my analysis of the growth of government and of the way in which the growth of government is related to other social and economic changes. I think in the hindsight, if we look at the past 100 years or perhaps a little more, not only in the United States, but also in all of the economically advanced countries, all of the countries of Western Europe, for example, the growth of government has been one of the most important social and economic changes to have occurred. And it has many aspects. It's a difficult subject to study because it's not one single thing that we can measure as we might measure height or weight. Government in the modern era performs countless functions and undertakes so many activities, interacts with so many other parts of the social and economic world that we find it everywhere. Hardly anything in modern life in the advanced countries is completely free of the influence or control or effect of government action. For many people, that's a good thing. For me, it verges upon a disaster. I place the highest value on individual freedom. And for the most part, although many people look to government to liberate them in some way, I believe they have found that the result of calling upon government to perform a variety of tasks has had exactly the opposite consequence, that the ultimate result of reliance upon government for security, for the provision of goods and services, for all sorts of tasks that modern governments carry out, has been a catastrophe for individual liberty. Few of us are aware of it now because it did not happen all at once, but I am convinced that if the Americans of 100 years ago were to find themselves transported by a time machine to the America of today, they would feel that they had landed in a hellish tyranny. They would be astonished that their descendants had permitted themselves to be so controlled, so placed under surveillance, so ordered around, so taxed, so regulated, that scarcely any move can be made privately and independently any longer. We have almost reached the stage in my country where everything that is not required is forbidden. Now, that may seem like a terrible exaggeration. Certainly, the Americans are constantly shouting to the world about how free they are, and even making audacious moves to bring freedom to others. But I'm afraid that the average American citizen has completely lost touch with what freedom really means, and has allowed himself to fall for government propaganda again and again. Now, you might wonder how a people that once took such pride in its independence and its individuality should fall into such a desperate condition. And I believe that much of the answer has to do with what happened during a series of national emergencies that the American people found themselves in. This story has some similarities to stories that have occurred elsewhere. I don't think the logic of the growth of government in the United States is unique to the United States. In many ways, we can see the same forces at work in many other countries. But the United States is the country I know best, and the one to which I've devoted most of my research. And so I speak with more confidence about its history than about British history or Swedish history or German history. I certainly know very little about the history of the Czech people, although I know some things. And so I would not venture to make hasty generalizations that I have a theory that applies to every country or even to every Western country. But I do believe these same kinds of events have taken place in many different countries. They have a logic. The logic is one that begins with a suddenly aroused state of fear. And this helps to explain the title of the checkbook, The Political Economy of Fear. One of the chapters in that book is specifically titled that way. Fear seems to me to be the strongest of human emotions, the passion that activates people most greatly. We all know many passions. We know envy. We know lust. We know anger. But nothing that we may feel as human beings moves us so quickly and so strongly as fear. We're animals. All animals know fear. And it may be that human beings, because they have consciousness, know fear even in a way that other animals do not know fear. I think that is true. But we do know that people can be scared, and they can be frightened by many different kinds of events. They can fear invasions from outside their country, by foreigners who may treat them badly. They can fear natural disasters. I live not far from the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, and so I have been part of a great natural disaster myself recently, and I know how it can make people afraid. But certainly more terrible fears have arisen on other occasions in other places. People may fear the loss of employment in an economic catastrophe. They may fear the loss of their property or their homes in an economic depression. There are countless bases upon which people may be very, very frightened. Frightened people look for a way out. They look for salvation. They look for someone to help them. historically, the American people did not look very far. They looked first to themselves. They were accustomed to self-reliance. For centuries, the Americans had little alternative but to rely on their own efforts. The efforts of their neighbors, their friends, the people with whom they went to church, they might be helpful too. But people did not look very far away from their own situation for help when they were desperate. All of that began to change toward the end of the 19th century. The economy began to change as it developed industry and great cities and national commerce and international commerce, and life became somewhat more complicated, somewhat harder to understand, somewhat more subject to incomprehensible fluctuations. Farmers might find, for example, that the price of wheat dropped 50% from one year to the next, and they had no idea why. They didn't know it was because a bumper crop had been brought in from Argentina or Canada. But they knew that this kind of drop in their income threatened them. They might be unable to pay their debts. They might lose their farms or their homes. Workers in industry found that they could not rely on employment. Hard times came. They didn't understand why the employer suddenly refused to hire them anymore and set them adrift, where they were forced to look for some other employment at a time when all the employers seemed to be reducing their employment rather than adding to it. So the changes in economic life that accompanied economic development everywhere brought new insecurities to people, and they began to look for reasons why those changes were occurring and for reasons for ways to offset them, to combat them, to do something to prevent that insecurity. In those circumstances, there was no shortage of people with explanations, people with ideas about why events were happening, about what might be done or should be done. Socialism had begun to develop in Europe in the mid-19th century, and socialist ideas began to spread to America as the Europeans immigrated to America. Most of the 19th century socialist leaders in the United States were Europeans. But some people found socialist ideas congenial. It gave them a way to understand a world that was almost incomprehensible to them. They began to like the idea that perhaps nationalizing the railroads, nationalizing industry, nationalizing the banks, would eliminate some of the troubles they found themselves in from time to time. So many ideas were preached. Many agitators went about trying to win converts. Now, for the most part, they didn't have great success because these hard times did not last very long, and as times got better, most people found themselves in better economic condition, and they decided that the system worked pretty well. There was a famous book written by Werner Sombart, a German sociologist, published in 1905, and the title of the book was "Why Is There No Socialism in the United States?" And Sombart's answer was, "It was roast beef and apple pie. The American workers had life too good. Their standard of living was so high they could not be made interested in socialism. The system seemed to be serving their purposes quite well." I don't especially recommend Sombart's book, but there's a wonderful book by historian Eileen Craditor that establishes the same point beyond dispute, I believe. that socialism never got much of a foothold among the working masses of America. It got some. But socialism did appeal to the growing intellectual class. And that was the beginning of a extremely consequential course of events. Because this socialist thinking that penetrated the intellectuals of America began to be taught in the best universities. It began to be written about by journalists in the best newspapers. It began to shape the climate of opinion. And as it did so, it gradually percolated down to more and more people for whom these ideas ceased to sound strange. They got used to certain proposals for government action, for government takeovers of industry. So even if they didn't think those ideas were good ones, they stopped being shocked when they heard such ideas. We came then to the first of the great national emergencies of the 20th century, which was engagement in World War I. At that time, the government, having decided to wage war and having no armed forces of any consequence, had to quickly build up its armed forces and its industrial capacity to supply them, to transport them to Europe, and to maintain their fighting capacity. In order to do that, the government was unwilling to wait for market forces. It was unwilling to simply go out into the market and purchase what it needed to build up its armed forces. To speed the process, it began to take over industry or to impose controls on private industry. It nationalized the railroads. It nationalized the communication system. It issued regulations for all the farmers. It organized industry into some 75 areas, each with government controllers and regulators. It fixed prices so that the goods government wanted to buy in great quantities would not have rising prices to raise the government's budgetary costs of fighting the war. In many, many ways, the government undertook to speed its war making by setting aside the market economy and imposing direct controls and allocations. Of course, many people didn't like these actions and resisted them. When the government began to conscript men for service in the army immediately after the declaration of war in April 1917, many men resisted. And many Americans, even senators, stood up and said this was un-American. It was, according to many people, Prussianism, not what Americans do. But Americans do what everybody does. We're no different. And our government is no different. It's just as ready to bring violence to bear against its enemies as any other government when it feels it has no alternative. So in World War I, to suppress resistance, it imposed censorship on the press. It took vocal dissidents and tossed them into prison. It sent its spies all over the country to find out about people who were preaching draft resistance, to find out about people who were uttering anti-government words. And in 1918, it passed a sedition law which forbade virtually every form of criticism whatsoever against the government. Such things had never been seen before in America. But they were emergency actions. They were always justified as emergency actions. Even the people who supported them said, it's just for the emergency. When the war is over, all of these things will end and we will return to the status quo ante bellum. But there's never a return. A great American sociologist, William Graham Sumner, once wrote, "You cannot experiment with a society and just drop the experiment when you choose. The experiment enters into the life of the society and never can be got out." That's what happened to the American people and to other people as well during World War I. They experienced extreme government controls, commands, and dictation. Abuses, even. Some of them liked it. They were on the beneficial end. They were working for government. They were benefiting from the government's economic controls. They were in the protected press, not the censored press. People always look for ways to make the best of a bad situation. I suppose I don't have to tell an audience of Czechs that. You've had bad situations. You know people look for the best way to deal with them. Well, Americans looked for the best way. Some accommodated, some didn't. But the emergency did end, and most of the wartime controls were dropped, but not all. After that emergency, as after each of the ones that followed, a legacy always remained. Attitudes were changed. New laws remained on the books. Bureaucracies created for war purposes found a way to extend their lives with new missions. So government grew. A government that had been growing slowly got very big in the emergency, fell back after the emergency, but not all the way back. It then resumed a slower growth until the next emergency, which was not a war, but the onset of the Great Depression, which was called by some Americans an emergency more serious than war. And for most people, it was. It directly affected them. It threatened their livelihood. It threatened their wealth and their property. It frightened them. It scared them to death. And they looked for a savior. And they looked where they had looked before and where public opinion had prepared them to look. They looked to the state. And they demanded that it do things it had never done before. And the politicians were ever so willing to seize those new powers. And they did seize them. And the result was what is known as the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. A period of economic control never experienced in peacetime in the United States. Great new bureaucracies established to control banking, financial securities, labor markets, product markets of all kinds. So many regulations, it would require an entire book just to give one page to each of the new bureaucracies. That experience of the New Deal and the Great Depression continued in the United States for a long time, all the way from Roosevelt's taking office at the beginning of 1933 until the war, World War II, replaced the old emergency with a new kind of emergency. Some Americans misunderstood what happened when World War II began. They say World War II ended the Depression, as if that were a great thing. Thank God for World War II. And they mean it. They really believe that World War II brought economic prosperity back to America. It did nothing of the sort. In fact, if one looks at the part of national production that was useful to people for raising their standard of living, it actually dropped from 1941 on and did not recover its 1941 level until after the war had ended. However, everyone was working during World War II. Unemployment had certainly been eliminated. But the secret to eliminating unemployment in that case was simple. It had nothing to do with Keynesian policies. It had nothing to do with shrewd government fiscal management. It had nothing to do with the Federal Reserve System. It had everything to do with the fact that more than 10 million men were drafted. And millions of others were frightened into joining the armed forces for fear that they would be drafted. Joining was better because you had a better chance of staying out of the dreaded infantry, where even if you didn't get killed, you were going to live like a dog. So the United States brought 16 million men at some point during the war into the armed forces. And in 1945, it had a standing force of 12 million. Well, that's a good way to get rid of 7 million unemployed. Works every time. But it's not prosperity. It's not recovery from a depression. It's simply the substitution of one misfortune for another. But it tricked a lot of people. They were earning money. They were earning high wages, they thought, even if rationing and price controls prevented them from obtaining the goods they normally would have obtained with their earnings. And after the war, everybody was better off, because then, when the war ended, most of the controls, not all, were dropped. People returned to civilian employments. And finally, the economy did have genuine prosperity. 1946 was the best year of all time for the American economy. The private part of national product grew by more than 30% in a single year. Nothing like that ever happened before or since. So it was glorious, and people had a tendency to accept the fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc. They thought the war had caused the resumption of prosperity. But it wasn't the war as such. It was events related to the war. I won't take the time to tell that story to you, but it is a different story, and one about which I've written at length. Think about this period from 1917 to 1945. During that time, the American people had been battered by national emergencies, one after another. The first one brief, the second one long-lasting, the third one enormous in scale, affecting almost everything and everybody. After passing through all of those experiences of government control, of government promise of security, the character of the American people was transformed. People that had independence, people who had personal reliance, no longer possessed it. They had either found a way to work themselves into the system in some beneficial fashion, as many businessmen did, for example, looking for government contracts, looking for cozy arrangements created by regulation, as many workers had, looking to labor unions protected by government, as many consumers had, looking to government to protect them from faulty products, as many small businessmen had, looking to government to protect them from competition. Everybody had somewhere in government to look for his own personal salvation. And at that point in 1946, they had great experience with how such government programs might work to serve their interests. So they were no longer interested in returning to the world of 1914. They weren't any longer that kind of people. Sometimes when the historian reads the testimony of the old people looking back from, say, 1950, it's quite striking the contrast that was apparent to them. They knew that the American people of 1950 were not at all like the ones they knew before World War I. And some Europeans tell similar stories. It was a horrible series of experiences that changed people's relationship to the state. And it changed it for the worse, because it eliminated their old desire for personal freedom, for individual autonomy. It made them dependent upon the state. It virtually led them to give up their old gods and accept the state as their new god. You see that now when you see Christians faced with a choice between doing what is Christian and doing what the government of the United States tells them to do. They not only automatically do what the government tells them, their religion be damned, but in many cases they actually believe that is a good thing, to obey every government edict, no matter how much it places them at variance with their religious tenets. So we've created a new man. You know, the communists said they were going to create a new man, and we know they failed. But the communists went about it all wrong. It turned out that without even trying, it was possible to create a new man. And we've created one in Western Europe and in the United States and in other places. Whether we can recreate the old man, I doubt very much. I hope we can. I hope we can continue to fight a government that's so oppressive that it controls virtually every move we make. But I'm not an optimist. I'm a historian.
Thank you. The floor is open for some optimistic comments. Which can be on anything from American Progressive Era to contemporary politics, war on terror or war on drugs.
My name is Svoboda, and so you have criticized the government what they did during the wars. So what would be your recommendation to do?
Best of all is not entering the war. The whole world would have been enormously better off had the United States never entered World War I. Many of the horrors of the 20th century can be traced to that event, because it made possible the Versailles settlement and many of the consequences. It made possible the triumph of the Bolsheviks. It set in motion the remaking of the world at Versailles that was mistaken in almost every detail, some of which we're still dealing with today in the Middle East. So the best thing to do is not go to war unless there is no choice. But there was a choice for the United States on every occasion, even in World War II, because World War II was very much a war of choice. It's true the Japanese did attack, and the Germans did declare war on the United States, but many things were done before that time to provoke the Japanese with economic sanctions that were threatening their livelihood, and to provoke the Germans in various ways, including close cooperation and supply of England and France in the war. So the United States need not have entered either of the world wars, and the world would have been a better place had it not, I believe. One can never know for sure, because we can't redo the experiment of history with one thing changed, but I believe we have good basis for arguing that. Now, if the country is going to war, of course, the best thing to do is to minimize the invasiveness of government policy. People who talked about war, for example, Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, did not necessarily oppose all wars, but they did believe that it was a great mistake to impose what they called war socialism, for the government to take over industries and to immediately conscript in one way or another the economy for war purposes. To the extent possible, if a government leaves the market economy in operation, it can actually have a more successful war economy, because command economies are inefficient by their very nature as compared to market economies. And the more the government can rely on the market economy to get what it needs to fight the war, the more efficiently it will be able to fight. These takeovers claim to save time and save resources and to somehow save money, but those are illusions. It's just a way of hiding the inefficiency that's created. The only way to make people do something faster is to reward them for speeding up the process. Faster production is more costly, and so speed has a higher price. If you're not willing to pay that price, you can hide it by substituting commands for bids in the market. But you haven't hidden any real costs. You've simply shifted it onto new parties. Rather than the taxpayers picking up a higher price, you've shifted the cost onto people who must take actions they would not take except for commands.
My name is Umjit Kumar. Your words were very interesting, but I'm afraid that on the basic ideas, I will totally disagree with you. Let me allow some comments on what you have said. Mm-hmm. First, I don't think that your definition of state in America is correct, because what we understand by state and state influence in Europe is a bit different. It means also social responsibility and social services to people, which are the things that are not very developed in American state. So if you have carefully read some philosophians and historians, you would have known that American state was in serving only very small people, big business, and literature, Wall Street, big business. And I understand, from that point of view, I understand your fear of this strong state, Washington, big business. It's understandable for me, but as I understand the notion of state, it's a bit different. So if I lived in America, I would be also feared of the state, because it's state without social responsibility, and it's state that is trying to declare that he's serving to people, but I don't think so, it's true. So that's first my argument. Second, you have said that the American man has changed during a period of from 1914 to 1950. Mm-hmm. That's right, but is that wrong? Is that wrong? It's natural mm-hmm. Process, and always men are, people are changing, mm-hmm. and I don't think that why it should be the truth that ideal state is on the turn of century. The second, it was my second argument.
One last.
And one last, yes, thank you.
More than
I never understood why you liberals, if I can call you that, believe that the world without state is something like heaven. I don't understand why it's true, because fear of people, economic fear is not from the state. Unemployment is not, people are not feared from state. Many millions of people who are working for supranational companies are not fearing of state, but they feel fear of the boss, of being fired of the firm. So I don't think it's primary fear in economy is fear of state.
Well, the idea that the governments of Europe are different is a difference only of degree rather than of kind. The Americans' government now provides a vast range of social services, everything from old age pensions to health care, to rent subsidies, to free lunches for school children, and you know, it could go on for thousands of pages to just list all the social services. Now, it is true that the Americans do not spend as big a part of the national income on those kinds of services as the European welfare states do. But it's a difference, as I say, only of degree, not of kind. Now, in either event, however, the objection is that these benefits provided by government do not come from thin air. When goods and services are employed for one purpose, they must be withdrawn from another purpose. And in Europe, we see this in the form of the very high tax rates. The very large fraction of national income that's withdrawn from the people who earn the income by producing, and then the governments redirect or redistribute that income heavily in the form of a variety of services of all kinds. Whenever government redirects income like that, it's relying ultimately on its ability to use violence or the threat of violence against someone. If people don't feel like paying taxes to the French government, then ultimately the French government will hurt them. This is not something, despite elections being won by certain politicians, that is voluntary. The state is always different from the people who bear the net costs of supporting the state's purposes. Democracy has made people fall into the illusion that they are the state, but they are never the state. Only the people who control the means of violence directly are the state. Those of us who have a vote, or those of us who can have a statement, standing up in a public meeting, we are not the government. We fool ourselves to think that we are. Now, your second question about why is it a bad thing, I certainly agree that people do tend to change. In modern societies, many things change, and this has an effect on the nature of the people who inhabit those societies, of course. The people of 1914 were not the same as the people of 1714. Though it might have not had much to do with government. But the reason I emphasize the change between 1914 and the period since World War II is that in the United States especially, but to some extent in other countries also, the change in people was one that diminished their desire to be responsible for themselves and diminish their desire for individual freedom, and led them to immediately look to their governments to save them from every form of possible trouble and difficulty in life, and until now it's reached the point where even insults are illegal. One can't even speak certain words because the government has said that this will be an insult in the ears of someone else. So one's very utterances have come to be controlled by the governments, as well as the conditions upon which one can work, the conditions upon which one can operate a business, and so forth and so forth. As well, of course, as the control of one's own earnings after they're received. And finally, your question number three was
liberal heaven.
The my answer, I don't pretend to speak for all liberals, but my answer is that everything that is really desirable that government does can be done without government, and it can be done better without government. Now, one might think, what would happen if we eliminated government tonight? Wouldn't things be catastrophic tomorrow morning? Well, perhaps they would be. But if we made an orderly transition and allowed sufficient time for people to discover, to try, to find out what works best for them and is acceptable to them, no one would be compelled to enter into any transaction against his will in the liberal paradise. So it wouldn't be like the world in which we all must pay taxes, we must obey regulations, or the state will ultimately bring violence to bear against us. And for those of us who abhor violence, we want to minimize government. In the world of our dreams, we want to eliminate it completely because we prefer peace and harmony to violence. And that is the kind of world we want to create, a world of voluntarism, a world in which everyone's transactions are freely entered into, a world in which everyone can find his own way in the world without dictation, without policemen, without spies, without anyone constantly telling him how he must pursue his life.
Perhaps a small note on the European social services you mentioned and its link to fear. Well, as you may know, for example, if you take a case of unemployment, a typical European unemployment is some 9, 10, 11%, whereas typical American unemployment is 4 or 5. And what is sort of paradoxical, though not for economists, if you ask European people, German or French people or Czech people, whether they are afraid of losing a job, they will tell you that they are very afraid. The overwhelming majority of European laborers is scared to death from this possibility of losing unemployment because they know for sure that they are not getting social services from the government. They are losing a possibility to be productive. A huge bulk of European unemployment is long-term unemployment. For example, more than half of Czech unemployment is long-term unemployment, more than 1 or 2 years. So if you lose a job, you are in big trouble. That's the service you are describing as a big advantage of European social or welfare state. Whereas if you ask an American worker whether he is afraid, whether he fears losing a job, he will tell you that he will not be excited, but he knows that within a week or two or three, very likely he will find a good job. Or perhaps a little worse job at the beginning, but within a few months, he will get his good job back, which is not what is happening in Europe. And that is an extra reason, or perhaps a nice application of this fear eyeglasses and to see European or American or generally economic reality through it. Yes, please.
Jan, you commented, you shared your view about the development of the role of the government in the past. What's your view about the future? How do you see the future, let's say in 20 years, how develop the role of the government? I'm saying the environment of the globalization, integration, increasing role of the multinational companies in Europe, EU, I wouldn't be so much interested in the role of the US government and the Chinese, maybe rather about the European national governments.
One of the chapters in this book is relevant to that question. It looks at the continuing growth of government in the economically advanced countries, most of which are in the EU, and what it argues is that the growth of government is continuing, although some economists using certain measures have thought that the growth of government has leveled off. I believe it's continuing at a brisk pace, and I also believe it will continue to grow for some time. Now, it's obvious that governments cannot grow forever, because if government continues to become larger and larger relative to the rest of the economy, then ultimately there will be nothing to use, no basis for supporting the government's programs. It will either have to nationalize everything, which is automatically going to produce a disaster, as it did under central planning, or it will have to stop its growth. There are already some signs in Europe that pressures are causing governments and their supporters to reconsider particular measures. I believe that the Swedes, for example, have backed off a little bit from their very large government, the largest in Europe. And eventually, I believe that all the European countries will have to reduce the size of their governments. These very liberal, I should not use that word, these very generous provisions of social services, long vacations and family allowances and all of these housing provisions and things of that sort, very high payments to unemployed people, all of those things will have to be diminished. And the reason is that Europe is not alone. It exists in a world in which it will find itself unable to compete with countries that do not have to bear those burdens. We all know what's happening in Asia. Perhaps the Chinese will not forever be growing at 8% per year, but there's good reason to believe that the Chinese will be major players with an economy growing for a long time. And it's such a huge economy, so big, that it alone will put pressure on the world. But it's not alone. India is awakening, and its economy is starting to grow and modernize. And in both cases, those changes were set in motion by reasonably modest reductions in the role of government. And when the government lightened its hand a little bit and allowed people more room to maneuver in China and in India, cut back some regulations, reduced some taxes, gave people not anything like complete private property rights, but a semblance of private property rights, that was enough to motivate hundreds of millions of Chinese to become more productive. And the process has only begun. Now, Europe must compete. It cannot live in a world sealed off to itself. And it will find that if it insists on burdening its producers as it does now, it will not be able to compete. European producers have already been going abroad with their investment for a long time. I expect more of that to occur in the future. We all know from what is happening in France right now that even the smallest reduction of the welfare state can bring forth enormous protests. I think the Western Europeans, for the most part, are very much in love with their welfare states, and their political actions reflect that. But reality will assert itself. I don't believe they can go on like this and do more and more of it with the passage of time.
Perhaps I will add to it, to your note on multinational corporations that we, the Libera Institute and Alpha Publishing, we have a forthcoming book on that issue by Johan Norberg, a Swedish economist, the book called Globalization. And it actually explains the process of globalization in numerous ways, has chapters on environment and China and Africa and multinational corporations and all this, and is actually documenting on facts that many of what we believe is the reality of globalization is either not happening at all, or it's happening like differently, so that, for example, to give you one of these examples, you said that the role of multinational corporations is growing and everybody believes that. What Norberg documents in his book is, for example, if you have a look at the share of American GDP produced by the 50 biggest corporations, is actually falling, has been falling over the last 20 years. So as quite often in economics, we see development on both ends. You have perhaps more multinational corporations than a decade ago, but you have also much or many more smaller firms or middle-sized firms, and they grow too, and their numbers grow too. Typically what we hear and what we can read in the media is just this one half story of the overall picture, and people then tend to sort of be biased in one direction. So I hope our book will a little bit unbias at least some of the people. And the book will be released in a week. On next Friday, April 21st, Norberg is coming to Prague. We have a big conference called Prague Conference on Political Economy. Professor Higgs has one annual lecture, and Johan Norberg has also a lecture scheduled, and the book will be released. So that just appreciation of your point and our understanding as the Libera Institute that really these things are important to be studied and analyzed, and this little book is our contribution to the discussion about globalization, because we cannot avoid it. We just have to understand it better. Yes, please.
So my name is Mathieu Frenet. So as a historian, do you agree on Professor Hans Hermann Hoppe's thesis that the democratic governments are more likely to engage in wars, in a total war, than, for example, monarchies?
I believe democracies have shown they're more capable of engaging in total wars. The best book I know of that would be a kind of answer to your question is by Bertrand de Jouvenel. The book is called On Power. And what Jouvenel argues, I believe correctly, is that the development of democracy, because it led masses of people to believe that they were the state, that what the state did, they did, changed their thinking from what it had been in the age of monarchy, when everybody understood very well that, you know, the peasant was not the king, that the king had his own interests, that kings were always going to war to expand their domains and enlarge their splendor and seek their glory, but that was no cause for ordinary people to feel that it was their fight. And if they went, it was usually under duress or because they were paid as mercenaries well enough to entice them. But starting with the French Revolution, governments were able to mobilize much larger numbers of men for their armed forces. And I believe it is true that monarchies would have had much more trouble mobilizing not only huge armies, but also mobilizing entire populations to supply those armies and to cooperate with war measures. So yes, I am not in complete agreement with Hans Hermann Hoppe's argument. I'm not quite as sympathetic as he is to the rationality of monarchies. But nonetheless, I think the general point is correct, that democracies have been causally related to the emergence of mass warfare in the past 200 years.
I guess we have time for perhaps one last question.
My name is Hansi Sash from University of Economics. You have mentioned the tragedy of September 11. Can you tell us about the actions of the U.S. government and the impacts of these actions on American people?
Well, many actions have been taken. Of course, the most visible actions are the wars launched against Afghanistan and Iraq. And those have proven to be disasters, although the president continues to insist that all is well. The president is almost alone in insisting that all is well. Almost all Americans now perceive that these wars, especially the war in Iraq, was a disaster, a great mistake, and something that has created the potential for harmful consequences that will extend for many, many years in the future. But aside from the wars themselves, the government of the United States has used this opportunity of people's fear of terrorism to impose new surveillance measures and to change laws in a way that challenges the most fundamental legal basis of American liberties. The most important of those measures has to do with the government's insistence that it need not grant a writ of habeas corpus to the people it detains. That means that the government can arrest someone, hold him, never bring him before a judge, never try him, never give him a hearing, and if it wants to, simply go ahead and execute him, and all is well. Well, all is not well. That is the very definition of tyranny, when the leader can behave himself that way. Englishmen fought for centuries for the right of the writ of habeas corpus. All civilized people demand that the accused be given a hearing. And yet our government, on the basis of fear of terrorism, has claimed that it is not bound by these ancient obligations. It's imposed a series of surveillance measures, many of which it still does not admit, but exist nonetheless, in which the National Security Agency is using enormous fishing expeditions to plow through millions upon millions of telephonic transmissions, looking for keywords, the software fishing through there to find just the right signals to tell them that something wrong might be going on. But whatever the technical feasibility of these measures, and I think they're probably make-believe for the most part. I doubt very much that any real terrorists will be apprehended by these measures, but others will be. The Congress passed 6 weeks after 9/11 something called the USA Patriot Act, which challenges many civil liberties of Americans. And as I predicted at the time, the government would use that authority not against terrorists, but against others, especially against people attempting to evade taxes or people who are not obeying other government laws and regulations. And in fact, that is precisely how the Patriot Act has been used. So far, nearly every bank account seized by the government under the Patriot Act has been seized by the government's looking for tax evaders. people who have nothing to do with terrorism. The government doesn't even claim they have anything to do with terrorism. It's just that when you give the government a new power, you can be absolutely certain it will abuse that power. A government is far too dangerous to entrust with any task, and certainly far too dangerous to entrust with our most fundamental liberties.
So we ended up in a really pessimistic, true Hicksian mood. Thank you, Professor Hicks, for being with us.